90% of all scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. That's a lot of information. But don't panic. It's not an exact science.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Not too bad. It's been a little bit of a crazy day over here. It's only March, but I'm going to have to mow the lawn soon and watched a tornado almost touch down today.
So I was in class and a girl in the back this morning. So my classes are at 10:30 and it was like 10:45 and this girl in the back was like, "Oh my gosh, we're under a tornado watch." And I was like, "What?" And of course I checked my radar right then, and like there was this massive line of storms that had already popped up at like 10:45 this morning.
Yeah, so they got over this way in the afternoon, and we were working in the shop, and I looked at the radar and saw a textbook hook just west of us, and I was like, "Hey, everybody, like, let's go outside. We might get to see a tornado."
Wait, full disclaimer, you should always take shelter in these situations.
Right. But being the...
But you have a degree, it's fine.
Well, and, you know, we're from the Midwest, so...
Exactly, yeah, that is the exact thing you always do. Okay, cool. And, yeah. And you got a pretty good view, right? So, like...
Yeah, I mean, it's very flat around us. So we watched... It never touched down, but we watched a funnel get very, very low.
Oh!
It was...
How cool. That's amazing. It's great when you don't have to like go chase, right? We're too old to do that.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds exhausting.
Exactly. So much work. Eventually it'll make its way to me.
Yep. And as long as it's, you know, a decent ways away, somebody said, "Well, how are we in danger?" I said, "No, it's like 9 miles over there." Mm-hmm. Like, plenty of room.
Oh, that's super cool. Yeah, there's still some action going on right now. It's a weird day today. It was very juicy when we got up, and it just felt like one of those days, right?
Yeah, I went out to my truck at about 5:45 this morning, and when I came back in, I told my wife, "It feels like storm weather already."
Yep. Exactly. I noticed the concrete was wet, but it hadn't rained. I was like, "Oh yeah, that's a telltale sign right there." Well, speaking of the Midwest, I just got back from, we had a little field camp directors NSF workshoppy thing, for this mapping tool that I think we've mentioned on here before, StraboSpot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was developed by Doug Walker. He's a professor up at KU. And so we went to KU with 9 other people. And it was cool because it wasn't just like the geologists in the room talking about it. Like, we were there with some developers. And so it was the coolest, most productive meeting I feel like I've ever had.
Interesting.
Yeah, like, it was super fun to talk. It was really great because, you know, we're all out here doing these field camp things. And I think we feel... kind of like being a paleomagnetist. You never really have like 2 people in a department that are in charge of one, right? So to get like all these people together who are in charge of field camp and get to listen to what other field camps do, you know? And we were about 50-50 on people who had used it and people who don't use it. And that was also interesting too, to have that group of like, I'm a power user of StraboSpot and I've only seen it a couple of times.
Right.
And don't know how I would use it in a class situation. But then to have the developers there and to be able to say, yes, this is possible. No, that's impossible. Right on the spot to like, I feel like that conversation could have been all these, like this wish list of stuff that was just not even possible. So it was neat to have that person there to say, yes, this is totally doable. This is a great idea. No, this won't work because of this. Let's think of a workaround. So it's a really neat like field geology technology interaction. And it's actually got me excited enough that I've bought a mini iPad.
Really?
Yeah. It's a pink one. So what's interesting about this, so the Strabo spot does everything. The point of it is to take the place of your field notebook completely and your map. Take the place of everything, which is scary.
That is, but also could be very cool.
Exactly. And to take your place of your compass, as you know. And I think, I don't know if you used field move or clino move or whatever, field clino.
No.
That was one of the original, like, online mapping things. And a lot of people still use that clino software.
You forget how long ago it was when I took field camp.
I did.
The iPad was a year old.
Exactly. That's crazy. And your field instructor never would have allowed you to use that. So
I could have used it to write on, like, to put my paper map on it.
That is true. That is true. So this, like, Strabo spot's got some cool stuff. But the deal, why I got this, because obviously I am Android through and through, but they were telling me, this is cool, these are PhD students that are some of the development team, not all the development team that was there, but part of them.
Okay.
Or, which was impressive, right? And she was telling me that they can't do compasses for Android. So they took us out to their rock garden. The University of Kansas has this spectacular rock garden. And we were playing around with it. So everyone went to measure foliations because they're all igneous people. It was really weird. But so there's this amazing schist. And so everyone's going to go measure these foliations. And I'm like, I don't know if I could do this anyway, but mine wouldn't, like, the compass wouldn't work. And I was so embarrassed to be like, I don't know what's happening. And she comes over and she's like, oh, you have an Android. And they can't, the Android compasses are so random in their, like, variability of error that they just don't incorporate them at all because there's so many Android devices.
Right.
And it's not consistent. So they turned off the compass functionality. You can do everything else. So you can have your Brunton and measure with your Brunton and just input it, which was super easy because, of course, I had my Brunton. But yeah, I wanted to see what the iPad would do because everyone is just using their iPad. But you can go back and forth between, because it all saves everything to the cloud as you're working on it. And you just go back and forth between, like, your phone and your tablet and then download it on your computer and work with it there. So it's not like a GIS program. That's not what it's meant to be. It's meant to be your map and your notebook. And then you go take the data and do whatever you want to do in GIS or whatever.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a wealth of people that we can have on here to talk about it. And I'm sure if we have any undergrads listening, that a lot of them have used this Strabo spot. It's in its second iteration right now. And it's, I think, becoming pretty popular. So I don't know. I'm going to get one and play with it on my next field trip. And I'm probably going to wind up buying some mini iPads for field camp. I think I would want not a mini iPad for my own research. I don't know. I'm not sure if I want the mini or the big one. If I were out there, I think maybe a mini because it's probably about field notebook size.
Right.
So, yeah. Do you have a mini iPad?
I have a normal iPad. I used to have the big one.
Okay.
And I still have my old big one, which is the size of a sheet of paper, and I love that, but it's also super inconvenient to carry around. So now I've got the normal size one. I've thought about buying a mini one for flying.
Right.
But I haven't.
I wonder if they fit in the Plateau Designs pouches. I was just going to confirm that with you if you had one, but I'll just wait till I get mine.
No, I don't. I don't have one. We have the pouches in stock at the show.
Right, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. Hopefully by the next time we record, I'm supposed to get it and I'll download it and maybe I'll have a few things to say about it. I'm going to be super excited if, like, my suggestions make it into the actual software.
Sounds like maybe I need to come over and go on one of your field trips with you and we can just play with iPads while the students go.
Oh my gosh, we should totally do that. Because, yeah, okay. We will discuss this. I think it is a great idea. I'm going to the structurally complex part of Kimball Ranch next time. So, yeah. That'd be good.
That could be fun.
Yes. Yes. Interesting. But, you know, a whole bunch of limestones should be cool. It's really weird to be with all these igneous people that do field camp and to talk about the different places. Like, one of the directors, you know, teaches in Ireland and all this stuff. And it's also interesting to have, and I think this is worth it pedagogically speaking, is that you have this field notebook and a bunch of the menus are drop downs, right? Like, what are you measuring? What plane are you measuring? What line are you measuring? And you click on it and it's like, is this foliation? You know, is this trend and plunge? Is this rake? And it's like, oh, there are a lot of things you can measure on a rock.
Right.
And maybe it's a lot of stuff that, you know, we don't do a ton of igneous mapping, you know, that people wouldn't think about normally. So I think that was kind of cool too. It was cool for me to just be like, oh, these are measurements people are taking. And that's interesting because it's not stuff I usually think about because I'm not worried about those kind of things.
I feel like Dave and Lauren that were on a few episodes ago need to write a book called 101 Things to Do with Your Brunton. That's all the different measurements you can actually take in the field.
Oh, I was just thinking that that's at least two more shows we're going to do.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a very intriguing weekend. It was a lot to take in, but I'm real glad I did it. It was super fun. I felt bad because I had to cancel a field trip to go do it, but it was worth it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what we can maybe cook up for some future shows with that. But, you know, you're saying that all these people were igneous people, and that actually means maybe I should be talking to them today, right?
Exactly. Yep, I served that one up to you because, yeah, igneous rocks are neither of our fortes, but some reason you want to talk about them today.
In fact, I want to talk about a big igneous rock called the moon.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah? What about it? It's up there. It's made of cheese.
Right. It's made
of
cheese.
Fun Paper Friday.
So we have had a lot of interesting things happen in the space exploration area in the last few weeks.
So I'm really, like, behind. I'm really nervous to say that I am behind on a lot of this news. So I'm actually super excited to talk about it because, yeah, it's been a very busy week before spring break. And so what's been going on? We landed some stuff up there, right?
Yeah. So,
but something weird happened.
Yeah. So there are lots of other podcasts like Orbital Mechanics that are way better at talking about all of this than we are. So we'll leave the space flight things to them. Other than to say that a private company, Intuitive Machines, landed a spacecraft on the moon a couple weeks ago now. There were some technical difficulties and it ended up toppling.
Oh.
But it did land. It did operate. So that's the first time that we've put something on the moon since the end of the Apollo program.
Unbelievable.
It really is.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Yes. So then we're getting now to this week. SpaceX had another test flight of Starship, which was classified as a success. It broke apart coming back in, but they expected that to happen. So there's been a lot of push to get people and resources out into space and to study the moon more. And I've heard a lot of people say, why are we studying the moon? We've been there and done that.
Yeah. I feel like that's been a big conversation for a while now. Like, do we just put all our eggs, meaning all of our money, into the Mars basket? Or do we work on the moon where we know a lot about it already, right? I don't see why the answer isn't both.
Right. And I mean, one of the most expensive things about spaceflight is getting out of Earth's gravity well.
Yeah.
We've got to carry all this fuel and metal and supplies up out of this massive gravity sink. If we launch from the moon, which has long been an idea, you have a much lower gravity well.
There you go.
But in addition, the moon has a ton of resources.
Yes.
And that's what I wanted to talk about today, is what resources are there on the moon that we could use, and is space mining worth it, and can we even do it? Because who owns the moon?
Yeah. I think as long as corporations don't own it, I'm pro whatever.
Well, we'll get to that, but funny enough, that may be the only legal answer.
Oh, man. Did you read Andy Weir's moon novel, right? Was that Artemis? Is that
what Yeah. It was? Yeah, Artemis, the city on the moon in the crater. It was great. Yeah.
It was great. And it's like, I think that that's probably, I just don't understand why we would put all our eggs in the Mars basket, because this thing out in space, outside our gravity, has so many resources, is right there. It's right there. Let's go.
It's only a quarter of a million miles.
Only a quarter of a million miles away. I mean, that's nothing. I've certainly driven cars that have way more miles.
There are Dodge Darts that have driven to the moon.
Exactly. That is exactly right. My parents' truck, they put a little moon sticker on it because it hit that number.
So
yes, my mom was very obsessed with that number and making it to the moon.
I mean, that's a great goal, right? But so
yeah, exactly.
Why should we go to the moon? What resources are there? And there's a lot there, but really three of them are crucial. Do you have any guesses?
They're probably going to be, okay, so the moon came from us, so its composition, I'm just talking this out. The moon came from us. Its composition is similar to our mantle. Mm-hmm. So it's going to have some heavies. So definitely iron, I'm guessing, right? I don't know what we would do with magnesium, but there's an awful lot of magnesium up there. I don't know if that's one of your
three. So, well, all of those would get grouped into maybe, like, rare earth metals or heavy metals.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So that's one of the three.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Great. That's one of the three. Well, I was just thinking about rocks. I don't know. What else would we get? I mean, there's not a ton of water.
Oh, but there is. That's one of them.
That's down, though. Okay, great, great.
At the poles, there's a lot of water.
That is true.
And water is really important because, well, one, you know, we can drink it, but that's no big deal. We don't actually drink that much water. Rocket fuel.
Okay.
We can split the water, and hydrogen and oxygen is one of the most energetic rocket propellants there is.
Okay, making it a great place to have a base from.
Yeah, because we don't have to carry all the fuel from Earth to get anywhere else up there. We just make it there.
Yeah. Okay. Water, minerals. I don't know. What else do we need?
Well, this one, I don't think anybody would guess. It's
like the it's not the lack of anything.
No, it's helium-3.
Oh. Are we talking about nuclear stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
So helium-3 is one of two weird isotopes where you've got more protons than neutrons. So we've got two protons, one neutron. If we had one proton, it would be hydrogen.
Yes.
Yep. And helium-3 has some properties that make it really favorable for nuclear fusion. Fusion reactors based on helium-3 only produced low-level radioactive waste, and they run very efficiently. But helium-3 is very rare here.
Right.
There's a lot of helium-3 on the moon.
Is it something you have to drill for?
So the extraction of it appears to be somewhat amorphous right now. We don't really know a lot, but it's probably more of a strip mining operation in permanently dark areas.
Oh, so it's on the regolith.
Right.
In the regolith. Aha. Okay. Interesting. That's very interesting. I remember a long time ago that, this was back when I was an undergrad, somebody came and gave a talk and said that all the helium in Earth came from the nuclear reactor that was, like, at the center of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very controversial talk, obviously. It was the most packed our colloquium has ever been in my memory. And it went until, like, 6 p.m. So, yeah, okay. So helium's a big deal. How interesting that it's in the regolith. And so is it, like, photoreactive? Is that why it's in the dark spots?
I think it's more of a temperature, because you don't off-gas it if you keep everything okay. cold.
Okay. Oh, all right. That makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And
just...
That one's kind of like the wild card for me of what could we do if we had enough helium-3 to power our world with fusion?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd probably make bombs because that's what we do, but...
Right. We would somehow weaponize it, of right. course, right?
Yes, of course we would.
But
is there enough that, like, it's good enough for beyond, or is it enough to sustain us if we lived on the moon? Like, what are we talking about the uses here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. And, well, I saw a few interesting points. One was some people say, well, we shouldn't bring what's on the moon back to Earth. That's not a good use of energy and resources. We should just use it in space.
Okay.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. If we can, in an energy efficient way, get it back to Earth, why not? That's where we need it the worst.
Okay.
But just some back of the envelope math. If we were to use a metric ton of regolith a day, which I know in a, you know, a big mining operation is going to take many hundreds of tons a day.
Right.
But
yeah.
Let's just, you know, order magnitude this. Okay. So if we use a metric ton of lunar regolith a day, it would take 220 million years to have processed 1% of the moon's mass.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So there's plenty.
There's lots.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's not like Earth where a bunch of it's covered in water or a bunch of it's covered in people. It's a big, lifeless chunk of rock.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. So, okay. We're not gonna use up the moon anytime soon. Then you start looking at some statistics about things like rare earth metals. So right now, about 90% of our rare earth metals that go into all of our technology are located in China. That's where we mine them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the Chinese government's estimate is that they have 15 to 20 years of economical mining left.
That's nothing.
Which is partly why we're seeing a lot of efforts to recycle technology.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we really need 20. Some of that stuff here quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Like 20 years left. That's nothing.
Right.
I mean, and this is different than, say, other space mining operations like harvesting asteroids, because those are mostly going to be heavy metals.
Right.
Not this other stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, we're looking at yttrium and some of these things. But there's also batteries, a lot of copper, aluminum, iron, all that, like you said.
Right. Mm. This is very interesting. I hadn't gotten down here, but just a cursory search online seems like this is a really big rabbit hole.
It is. And really, so have you ever seen the science fiction movie Moon?
No, but I know the premise.
Yeah, it's a space mining operation with mm-hmm. some interesting twists. Yeah, I think it actually got a decent amount right. About in that movie, there's one person on the moon who's stationed there for some number of months, whose job it is to monitor and maintain all the robots that do the processing of the regolith. And there's just these huge, huge robots that are churning through the regolith, making these big grid patterns, processing it, and launching valuable materials back.
Okay, back home to Earth.
Like,
okay.
I actually think that part of the movie is pretty solid.
Interesting.
I don't know how long it'll take us to get there.
Right.
But we're pretty good at mining on Earth. Mining in space has some advantages for sure. Gravity, for one, being very small. Mm-hmm. Not having to deal with that pesky atmosphere.
Yeah, get out of here.
Also, one of the more interesting ideas that I found while researching this was, okay, well, we know there's going to be a ton of solar energy available on the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Well, lunar regolith is largely silicon-based.
Right.
So, there's a group that has been working on a technology to pretty much, like, scrape all the rocks and boulders aside so you get bare regolith and do a chemical process on it that deposits solar cells on the silicon base of the regolith.
Oh.
So you're just depositing the photovoltaic layer on top of the silicon that's already there and putting the grid pattern to extract the energy off of it. And you're kind of just paving the surface with solar cells to power your mining operation.
That is amazing. Wow.
So there was a lot of information out there on those options. Using robot miners, obviously, because that's how it's going to be cost effective. Instead of trying to put, you know, meat bags that take food and water and oxygen.
Yeah, exactly. Till we build the Artemis City.
Right. Interestingly enough, oxygen is also probably the most abundant thing we'll find on the moon.
Yes, which is a massive constituent in the mantle here.
Right. So we don't have to worry about oxygen either. But that would let us build, you know, our lunar base. There seems to be quite a bit of dependence on additive manufacturing, so 3D printing technology.
Okay. But that's not a problem.
Not a problem. And then there's also quite a bit of research on how do we store and transport helium-3 efficiently. Mm-hmm. Because we can power things on the moon with it, though I don't know that we would. We have lots of free solar.
Right, yeah.
Now, you do have to deal with, you know, the 2 weeks of light, 2 weeks of dark.
True.
Issue. But... And I do believe in Artemis, I don't remember if it was helium-3, but there were storage tanks involved in Artemis that played a plot point.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting ideas out there around how we could extract some of these resources. What I then found interesting, and didn't go as deeply down this rabbit hole, was exactly what you said. Well, who can do this? So in 1967, the UN created the Outer Space Treaty, which said no nation could claim ownership of any part of the moon or celestial bodies.
Oh, no.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
There is a whole group of law experts now called space law experts.
Wow.
So... The treaty says that a nation can't own it, but it doesn't explicitly bar private ownership.
How come this hasn't been amended immediately?
So, miners could theoretically claim property rights.
Go stake claims on the moon.
Right.
You are kidding me. Surely someone is planning to do this already, right?
Oh, definitely. And... I found an interview with one of these space law experts, and they're like, well, what's going to happen? You know, how are we going to interpret this treaty? There were some other pieces of legislation signed recently encouraging lunar mining in the U.S., and other countries have followed. And the lawyer said, well, until we get there and actually have to fight it out, we don't really know what the law is going to be.
Oh, my gosh.
So probably people will start staking claim, and very similar to the gold rush, there will be fights. Some of them will probably be in court. Some of them probably won't.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens.
This is atrocious. So I read a lot because this is the realms of the internet that I work in. I'm like not working, that I get lost in. I'm like crazy anti-advertising. I think it's ruined all of humanity. That's a whole separate discussion. But a lot of what I've read, you know, is stuff like McDonald's displaying, you know, their logo on the moon. And then the associated, well, who's going to stop them?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would be really angry if humanity allowed that to happen.
So another interesting thing was that just like with mining on Earth, there are impacts. But to me, the impacts on the moon are not, I don't want to say important, but yeah, that's the gist of it.
Because there's no disruption of life.
Right.
At all.
There's no disruption of life. We're not in anyone's lifetime going to change the face of the moon as observed from Earth. I don't see the problem, but of course there are people that do and are trying to adamantly stop this immediately.
It's like this, there's this fight in the outdoors community that I find outrageously intriguing, and it is for or against cairns.
Yes.
And it is vicious. And I get that. And so cairns are those little, just like a stack of rocks.
Right.
Right. And they're clearly not natural. I find them unbelievably comforting. Like, I think it is the coolest thing to be on a hike somewhere or even just out in the woods somewhere and see a cairn. Like, it's a cool thing that's like another human was here.
Right.
They thought this place was special enough to leave this mark. How neat is that? I'm going to also share in this. I'm going to add a rock to it, or I'm just going to enjoy it. I have a ton of pictures of cairns. I think these are really cool. And it's like, man, I even think just right off the cuff, if I were looking in my telescope in my backyard and I could see how we had changed the face of the moon, or see, you know, little lunar city or something like that, or even a mining operation, that'd be kind of cool.
Right.
Like, that's really neat. That's comforting. Like, our people have made it all the way out there. That's kind of, that's awesome.
Also, like, if we're going to survive, we're going to have resource to survive. And we can either do it by destroying things on Earth where there is life that we can harm, or we can go mine a big lifeless rock.
You know, I made this comment like 10 years ago in a meeting where we were talking about like what faculty, like what's the, you know, plan, 5-year, 10-year plan for the department. And I was like, we need somebody that's into mining because we're going to be mining asteroids. And I remember people laughing at me. And I thought, what kind of, have you guys not read any science fiction ever at all?
Right.
Why do you think that's a joke? And now I heard somebody the other day, I was like, man, we should really invest in, like, mining for, like, the asteroids. And I wanted to scream, be like, I said this 10 years ago in this meeting, you know, because that's exactly right. Like, that's going to be really hard to capture an asteroid. But, man, if we did, you know, there's a lot of fights about strip mining on Earth. How about we don't do it at all? How about we just go get stuff elsewhere? You're exactly right.
Yeah. Do you want to deface the moon, or do you want to make sure that more species go extinct in your lifetime?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. I hate that space law experts are just like, well, we just got to get there and find out. That's awful. But
that's so.
But I mean, it's true too, though.
I will leave this lawyer and the specific situation nameless and who was involved. But it was many years ago, and the parties involved no longer care. But was talking to a lawyer about the legality of something. And he said, well, the document that you signed was really more of a promise. And promises get broken all the time. And that was my first real insight into how lawyers have to think to be good at their job. Which is, well, you know, we can debate it for a long time, or we can actually go do something and fight it out in court. Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. Very, very, very telling.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I just thought this was a really interesting topic to get a kind of a high level overview of, because I've heard about lunar mining and seen movies about it forever. But I was curious, well, what can we actually get? And with all the effort of people going back and trying to land things on the moon, I have heard the question more than once, like I said, about, well, why are we doing this? Why are we spending money on this? So I thought this would be a fun time to address that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't read a lot about this helium-3 issue, so I already know what I'm going to be doing for the next weekend fun internet reading.
Exactly, right?
I appreciate it.
And I've looked at some of these mining kind of startups, and mm-hmm. the basic idea seems to be we're going to send very small robots, like think smaller than compact car size, to start, because that's what we can send initially. That's what we can afford the fuel to send. And they will start a very slow process of processing very small amounts to make more fuel, to make more resources, so we can then put bigger things on the moon and sort of do this bootstrapping approach.
Right.
It's one of those things that you have to start now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It needs to be very far-sighted, right?
Yeah, and I don't think that people appreciate, and science fiction has done a great job of this for a long time, of emphasizing that space exploration is a slow burn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It takes generations of work.
Yes, which is even more obvious to me why we would go to the moon first.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so there you go. That was what I wanted to say about it. But, you know, you can't go to space if we're not working in three dimensions, right?
Oh, that's what I was going to say.
And that brings us to everybody's favorite segment of the show, Fun Paper Friday.
Yay! But I will also say that in the three-body problem, that's not necessarily a true statement.
You know, I was at a used bookstore last weekend, and somebody asked for the three-body problem, and they said, oh, we don't even bother putting it on the shelf because we sell it as soon as they come in.
Did you see that it's starting on Netflix at the next week, I think.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I know. It's very exciting. I saw it when I got on the other night, and I definitely screeched. I was so, so excited. That was a life-changing trilogy of books.
Yes.
That I kept at it because you said this is a life-changing trilogy of books. You need to read this. And it absolutely was, and I bring it up all the time. And if you haven't read it, you should absolutely read it. I don't know what the series is going to be like. Boy, I hope they do it justice.
Yes, I hope so. Hope it's not a Hitchhiker's Guide TV miniseries experience.
Exactly. Let's hope that is not the case. But, as you said, we got to prove we're 3D, or else our physics is going to be wonky. And it looks like somebody already did it.
Yeah, Tom Morley in the article, A Simple Proof That the World is Three-Dimensional.
I have to tell you how angry I am that I had to be subjected to the chain rule after 8 o'clock. I looked at that and said, oh, I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Right. So this is in the 1985 Society for Industrial and Applied Mathematics Review. And the section is actually really cool. It's in a section called Classroom Notes in Applied Mathematics. And it says, yeah. This section contains brief notes, which are essentially self-contained applications of mathematics that can be used in the classroom. New applications are preferred, but exemplary applications not well known or readily available are accepted.
This is so cool. Back when, you know, professors cared about teaching in addition to research. Very awesome.
Right. And they say in here, this would be suitable to present in a junior or senior level ODE and PDE class.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly remember talking about radio wave propagation in PDE, for right. sure. And so it's really funny, right? Because he says, obviously, the introduction is just like three sentences that start with, the title is, of course, a fraud.
Right. We prove nothing of the sort.
But I mean, sort of, right? Because they're talking about wave propagation, and it only works in dimensions 1 and 3.
Asterisk. It only works in odd dimensions.
Yeah.
Okay. So it only works in...
There's a lot of really cool written history of science stuff in here, too. I just wanted to point that out. So these are, like, really neat class notes.
Yeah, no, this definitely tickled my history of science fancy.
Yeah, it's really cool. But now you can do the chain rule, because I refuse to do that.
No, that's okay. So we start saying that, well, we know electromagnetic waves exist and work. Maxwell posited them. Hertz discovered radio waves in practice. Helmholtz was Hertz's advisor, but anyway.
Amazing.
Right. We know that radio and communications with electromagnetic waves work. So much of our modern technology is based on electromagnetics.
Right.
So they do this proof looking at, and oh, this brought back bad memories of like my candidacy exam.
Oh, nice.
It starts out, consider the n-dimensional wave equation.
And then you had to go, you know, rock in a corner for an hour before you could get back to it.
Right. So basically we do a bunch of math and we do some partial derivatives. Like if you got some chain rule in here and we come up with a set of equations that only have viable solutions if the number of dimensions is odd, specifically 1 or 3. Mm-hmm. But if you plug in dimension 1, everything works. But there's a catch, right?
Right.
There's no attenuation. So you make a electromagnetic wave, or a wave of any kind, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on forever in that forever. One dimension and never decreases in amplitude. We know that doesn't work.
Thank God.
Right. So, therefore, we are in a three-dimensional world.
See? Beautiful.
And I love in the acknowledgments, it says, the author would like to thank R.J. Duffin for historical discussions and an anonymous referee for contributing the final sentence. And the final sentence is, of course, a world without attenuation would be unbearably noisy.
Elegant, truthful. Here we are in three dimensions.
And in my opinion, like many important proofs, it takes just a couple pages.
It's short. That's exactly right. I almost quit reading when I read Chain Rule, and then I said, oh, this isn't bad at all.
No. This is something that if you have ever taken a differential equations class, you can read through without too much trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've had homework problems much longer than this.
Much.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So if you've got your own proof about radially symmetric wave fields and maybe theorizing that we could work in those higher order odd dimensions, or plans for lunar mining of your own, we'd love to hear them. Shannon, how can they get a hold of us?
Don'tpanicgeocast@gmail.com. We're on X at Don't Panic Geo, at Shannon Doolin, at Geo_Lehman. And as always, thank you to our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to support us, patreon.com/don'tpanicgeo.
And until next week, remember, don't panic.
It's not an exact science.
Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed are solely ours and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers or funding agencies.